I remember when the Korean War began, I talked to an expert on communism, and I asked him whether he thought the decision of the United States to go into Korea was right. He said, of course it was right. He said, you had to do it. He said, what you must remember is that for the communists, the war in Korea is not about Korea. It is about Japan. And of course, he was right. Because if Korea at that time in 1950 had been overrun by the communists, Japan, just then recovering from World War II, turning toward neutrality far more than it does today, would have inevitably been pulled under communist domination. And so it is with regard to Vietnam in a very different sense. The war in Vietnam is about Vietnam and those people long suffering for 20 years under communist atrocities, civil wars, whatever you want to call it. 70,000 civilians, for example, killed by the Viet Cong or taken into captivity or wounded over the last 4 years. And so the war is about Vietnam. But it's also about Southeast Asia, and you've heard this before. It is also about World War III. Because as Secretary Rusk said, I thought, quite properly the other day, the minimum condition for order on this planet is that aggression must not be rewarded. Because once it is rewarded, then it is encouraged, and you will not have order. And so it is with Vietnam. If aggression of a new sophisticated type through exporting and supporting a revolution succeeds in Vietnam, it will mean that aggression will be tried again. And so what we are thinking about and what we are doing in Vietnam is attempting to deny reward for aggression and thereby to reduce the danger of World War III. And finally, the war in Vietnam is about China, communist China. That tremendous, potentially powerful continental nation, 700 to 800 million people. And if you see Chinese outside of China, the most productive, the most creative people in Asia, perhaps apart from the Japanese. If you see what a million Chinese have done in the Philippines out of the 30 million that live there, if you see what 3 million have done in Malaysia, what 3 million of the 20 million who live in Thailand who are Chinese have done there, you realize what a remarkable people we have here and potentially what a great force for creative good they can be and what a great force for evil and destruction they can be. And here is China, under a communist government, and what's the war in Vietnam have to do with that? If it succeeds, China at this time in its history will have proved its point, and the hardline leaders of China, who are in a debate with the so-called softliners, will have won their point that this is a time not to have, quote, peaceful coexistence, end quote, with the free world, as the Soviet leaders have said since the Cuban confrontation. But this is the time to press forward with more aggression, more export of revolution. And so unless we succeed in our venture here, our venture, more than that, the free world's venture, of stopping aggression, it will mean that the danger of World War III will be increased. It means also that the danger of Chinese communist conquest of all of Asia will become inevitable. So these are some of the reasons why the administration has made the decision that it has had made in Vietnam. It is some of the reasons why many Republicans have supported that decision. Well, we argue about the methods. We argue about the methods because that's the role of, and that's the responsibility of the loyal opposition, to indicate those areas where policies can be implemented more effectively. And on that score, only one point I would make. Time is not on our side. Today, the Soviet Union and China are not allies. They were allies at the time of Korea. Therefore, as far as stopping Chinese and through their agents in North Vietnam, communist aggression in Vietnam is concerned, the risk is less now than it will be later in the event that the two could come together, which could happen. And second, as we indicated before, within a matter of 4 to 5 years, the Chinese communists will have nuclear weapons that they can deliver within a radius of 1,500 miles of the Chinese communist mainland. If the war in Vietnam still goes on at that time, the risk of it exploding into a bigger war, a nuclear war, might become too great for the United States to persist in its policy of stopping the aggression. And so, therefore, this is why Republicans, along with many Democrats, have joined in urging a policy not of withdrawal, not of continuing just what we're doing, but a policy of economic, diplomatic, and military quarantine of North Vietnam, using our military power not indiscriminately to level and obliterate the place, which would be, of course, a counterproductive move in every respect, but using it against military targets, using it to cut off the flow of supplies by sea, not because we want a bigger war, but because only by ending this war do we avoid a bigger war. I present this only as an indication of one of those difficult problems which current leadership is faced with and which the generation of which you are a part will be faced with for the last third of this century. Let me turn briefly to the problem at home. Here the question is, what kind of an America will best be able to develop the military and economic and political strength to lead the free world from a position of strength in this last third of the century? That was one of the issues of this last campaign, the campaign of 1966. It was not completely clear-cut because here again, Republicans differed and Democrats differed as to what the future of America economically and socially and politically should be. But in one sense, the issue was pretty clear. Because to millions of America, a very heady prospect was presented. When you added it all up, it went something like this. Why change? Why increase the strength of the loyal opposition? Because if we continue with the present top-heavy majorities in the Congress, which will do anything that the administration wants, there are a lot of new goodies which will be coming along, which will make over America. I am convinced that had there not been a change in the Congress, that this would have been how America would have looked after it was made over. It would have been a different America. Some would have liked it. See whether you would. It would have been an America in which a majority of the American people, not just the aged and not just those who needed and wanted it, but a majority, would have had their doctor bills paid by the government. It would have been an America in which a majority of the American people, not just those who needed it, not those who wanted it, would have had their rent subsidized by the federal government. It would have been an America in which all of the American people would receive the minimum income of $3,000 a year or so, whether they worked or are willing to work or not. It would have been an America in which the decisions as to what would be taught in our schools would be made not by local school boards, not by states, but by bureaucrats, leaders in Washington. It would be an America in which the cities of the nation would be planned, not with the rich diversity, which is the hallmark of freedom, but under control from Washington. These were just some of the programs which were in the wings, ready to come on stage, and which would have been enacted unless the strength of the loyal opposition had been increased as it was increased. And many might well say, what's wrong with all that? After all, the government's going to pay our doctor bills, the government's going to pay our rent, the government's going to guarantee us an income whether we work or not, the government's going to tell us what to teach the kids, federal government's going to plan our cities. This, many people said, would be a great society. I'll tell you why I disagree. And why I think millions of Americans intuitively voted for a change, a new approach. That isn't the history of America. America is a great country today. Oh, we have our faults. But travel abroad and come back, and you will become convinced again and again that this is a great country. How do we become that way? Remember this, if you forget everything else I say. America is great, and it became great over 190 years. Not because of what government did for people, but because of what people did for themselves and for their country. That's the history of America. And now we turn to the responsibility. It's so easy to use our opposition to big government in Washington as an excuse for doing nothing at home. And so the answer, of course, rather than bigger government in Washington, better government in the states. Rather than turning to government, always first turning to private enterprise where it can do the job. Rather than turning where a charitable or other activity is involved, always to government. Recognize that our strength is in our voluntary associations. America's strength, to oversimplify a complex question, is not just in its government. America's strength is in its people and in what we do in our individual and private capacities, as well as what we do as a government. And now I come to what is standard for, I understand, any speech before a university audience. One who has attended a college or a university is supposed to give advice, advice for the future. It's very different today, the advice I give you, than what I received when I entered law school 30 years ago, Duke University. That was in the midst of the Depression. And I remember our teacher, he was a professor of torts. He was a cynical idealist. A man who liked to shock his students. I remember he walked to the front of the classroom. This is the first time that we'd ever been in a law school classroom. We were from all over the country. And he said, "Gentlemen," he said, "I want to give you a formula for success. Everybody else is going to tell you to study hard and pass the bar and the rest. Remember this if you forget everything else. Marry for money and practice law for love." In those Depression years, we laughed too. But those that did probably also recognized that there was some ironical truth in it. Today, you're in a seller's market. Those who come from the colleges and the universities, oh, not all of you, it isn't going to always be easy. Nothing worthwhile is easy. But nevertheless, the need for talented and able and educated men and women is a growing one in this country. It's recognized, and you're fortunate in that respect. But my word to you has nothing to do with the jobs you seek, which you will get, or the professions that you enter. My advice to you has to do with a broader aspect of your lives in this last third of the century. I have spoken of these problems. Of the chances for peace with freedom, of the chances for a growing and prosperous America. And we all feel at a moment like this that we're a nation of destiny and we're a people of destiny. And all of us, I know too, intuitively want to know, are we going to play a part, and what part can we play? Let me state my view, if I can, with an analogy. After Nelson's great victory at Trafalgar, a dinner was held in the Guildhall in London for William Pitt, who at 45 had been prime minister almost half his life already. And he was toasted at that dinner as the savior of Europe. He responded to that toast with one of the shortest speeches a prime minister has ever made. And according to Lord Curzon, who wrote 100 years later about it, one of the three greatest masterpieces of English eloquence. He said, "I thank you for your toast, but Europe will not be saved by any single man. England has saved herself by her exertions, and will, I trust, save Europe by her examples." And so today, we live in a country where America, the free world, the whole world, will not be saved by any single man. That's another system. We live in a world where America, by her example and by her leadership, will save freedom for ourselves and for the world. And by America, we mean all of us. Now, I realize that sophisticated individuals here are going to say, "What do I have to do with these great decisions as to whether we bomb Hanoi or not?" And my answer is nothing directly, but a great deal indirectly. I'm simply suggesting this. There's a need for all of you in public service in one way or another. And I trust that you feel that need for two reasons. One, because the nation needs your creativity, your imagination, your youth, and your drive. Both parties need it. Local government needs it. State government needs it. And whether you happen to be in the private sector and engage in political activities as an avocation, or whether you happen to turn to public service, whether as a teacher in a great university or a college or a high school or a grade school or what have you, or whether you are in public service in some other way, I am simply suggesting that America at this time, as in no time in its history, needs the best that we can produce. We need the dissent, the competition of ideas that produces superior ideas. I'm well aware of the fact that we all can't be president. I found that out. But I do know that we can all play a part in who will be president or congressman or senator or state legislator. And this is what I urge you to undertake. One final thought in that respect. I realize others will urge a different course. I lived perhaps during those years of the 30s and 40s in what I call the syndrome, the security syndrome, and it reached a peak perhaps in the 50s in some quarters. It was a question always of don't borrow trouble, don't volunteer, don't dissent, don't worry, you might get ulcers, don't smoke, or you might get cancer, so on down the line. Now, a lot of these don'ts certainly should be adhered to, but what I am suggesting to you tonight is something very different. I am suggesting participation in controversy, not only in college and university, but later on. And I am suggesting it for a great reason. At the end of this century, you're going to look back, and you will look at these great decisions. And you will have missed something if you haven't played a part, some part. At some time in every life, a man must become involved in a cause bigger than himself. If he doesn't, he misses something. I think the Greek poet Sophocles, 2,000 years ago, put it most eloquently when he said, "One must wait until the evening to see how splendid the day has been." Most of those in this audience are in the morning of your lives. And you will live through a brilliant midday. And when you get to the evening and look back, that day will have been more splendid because you have participated in one way or another in making this country, which is the hope of the world, a better place in which to live, and a better leader for the world. Thank you.
Mr. Nixon has most graciously consented to answer your questions and has most generously, I believe, provided you with the boundaries. We have provided you with people to relay these to us, and there's some lovely young girls who are going to pick these up. So write the questions out that you would like to ask. We have people in three parts of the auditorium who will relay these questions to the platform. And we pause for about 3 minutes while you write some out if you wish.
The first question is, Mr. Nixon, if you are interested in running for president in 1968 and do not receive the nomination, would you run or accept a draft for vice president again?
Well, now, since I have not made an announcement as to what my plans are in so far as seeking the presidency are concerned, I do not believe it would be appropriate to indicate what I would do for the vice presidency. But I would suggest this, that I believe that the vice presidency is an office which is of great importance in our system. It is one, however, that I believe should generally go to and can better be filled by a man who has not held it before, and one who has been selected by the presidential candidate on the ground that the presidential candidate finds that he could best succeed him, and in the event that he did come to the presidency unexpectedly, and could best carry out the president's policies if the president gave him assignments to carry out. Now, I have tried to respond to your question indirectly, but I would only suggest finally this, that while this is not the time to say what I would do personally with regard to being a candidate in 1968 is concerned, there's one thing I can assure you. I will support the nominees of the Republican Party selected at the convention. Yes, sir.
We have a second question here. It's phrased, could not the escalation of the war in Vietnam serve to unify the Chinese or resolve their present internal difficulties?
I believe that the reason that the Chinese are having difficulties, one of the reasons, is the fact that the United States has not allowed them to expand through aggression in Vietnam, aggression by proxy in Vietnam, or in other parts of Asia. I believe that as far as what is termed escalation is concerned, that rather than that having the effect of unifying the Chinese, it would have the opposite effect of being more embarrassing to the Chinese, because the Chinese would find themselves unable to aid the North Vietnamese and the others whom they are instigating in this war. What we have to realize here is this, that when people suggest that the Chinese communists have not entered the war because they haven't been provoked, we have to realize that the Chinese communists have not entered not because of a lack of will, but because of a lack of power. And the fact that the United States has stopped aggression in Vietnam has put great internal stresses on communist China. By bringing the war to a conclusion through increasing military pressure on North Vietnam, I believe that will have the effect, of accelerating and frankly escalating the internal difficulties within communist China. I would add one further thing. Many people in discussing communist China and the necessity to, shall we say, have more communication with Communist China and bring them into the family nations, use the Soviet Union as an example. They failed to read history correctly, in my opinion. They failed to realize that the Soviet Union began to moderate, significantly moderate, its policies of overt and covert aggression toward the West only after they were confronted with the awesome power of the United States in the Cuban confrontation. Once they realized that the United States not only had the power, but would use that power to stop their aggression, it was then that the Soviet Union turned inward. That combined, of course, with the massive power that the United States and its NATO allies confronted them with in Europe. I believe we have a similar situation in China today. As China finds that it is no longer able to break out in Asia, as, for example, the free world positions are strengthened in Japan, I'm speaking not militarily alone, but economically and politically, in Japan, in Taiwan, in the Philippines, on all the perimeter of the Chinese Communist mainland. There, that kind of containment combined with a military containment in South Vietnam will increase the inward pressures on Communist China, which will, I think, result in more civil strife rather than less.
Do you support the occupation or bombing of most Vietnamese ports?
The occupation, would you repeat that again?
Do you support the occupation or bombing of North Vietnamese ports?
Ports. As far as the North Vietnamese ports are concerned, the port of Haiphong, the position I've taken, and this also has been the position of the Republican Coordinating Committee, is this. We believe that the flow of supply into Haiphong by sea should be cut off. Now, the question of how that should be cut off is a military decision. There are some who suggest that a blockade should be imposed. There are others who suggest that the port facilities, the docks and so forth, should be bombed. There are other military authorities who believe that the most effective and the least provocative method of cutting off the flow of supplies into Haiphong would be to mine the approaches to the harbor. When I was in Vietnam last August, it was this approach, speaking as one who was not a military expert, which seemed to me to make the most sense. Because mining does not involve, as blockading would, our taking the initiative, boarding and attacking, in effect, ships that are coming in. It puts the initiative on them for coming through the mines. And second, it does not run the risk that would be run in the event of bombing the port facilities. But the objective should be accomplished. And the objective, I think, should be accomplished with the least provocative method that we can find, but above all, the military decision in accomplishing that objective, I think, should be carried out.
Sir?
Yes, sir.
Should the American Communist Party be given a dissenting part in our government?
Well, the American Communist Party has a dissenting part in our government in one sense already. It has publications. Communists can make speeches. Some of them can make them on college campuses, and certainly they can make them in public squares. A communist can be elected to office if he's able to get the votes. As far as dissent is concerned, my view is that the United States is strong enough to allow open dissent by any group. On the other hand, I believe as far as covert activities are concerned, conspiratorial activities, activities in behalf of a foreign power, everything from espionage to violation of our laws dealing with internal subversion, that's something else again. So what we are distinguishing here is open dissent, a communist expressing his views as a communist, and using, on the other hand, the cloak of freedom for the purpose of destroying it through illegal or covert methods. The latter I would not approve. The open dissent under proper circumstances I would not object to. In fact, I think it is certainly healthy to have it exposed and then have it answered.
Mr. Nixon, the question is in two parts. Do you see any change in the present U.S. policy towards Cuba? And what developments, if any, do you see in the communist government of Cuba?
I have seen no significant change in the U.S. policy toward Cuba. And I personally would not advocate any change in that policy insofar as softening it is concerned. The only change in policy that I would support and would advocate would be to, through more effective diplomacy, enlisting the aid of our allies and those we have assisted in the past in their supporting the economic boycott that we have imposed on Cuba. Let me say this. I mentioned a moment ago our friends in Western Europe. I have been a supporter of aid to Western Europe. I supported the Marshall Plan and the Greek-Turkish aid program and all of the others through the years, which I think very properly were directed toward helping Western Europe recover after the devastation of World War II. On the other hand, to me, it is one of the greatest failures in American foreign policy in our history that some of our European allies, whom we assisted in war and then after war in peace to help them recover from war, it is a failure that some of those allies persist in aiding and trading with enemies, as in Hanoi, or potential enemies, as in Cuba. And I believe that we need more effective diplomacy to get our European allies, the Canadians and the others, to join with us in the economic